defeat in American history. Who did it? Cope asked. Sitting Bull, Ransom said. Custer charged Sitting Bull's camp without scouting at first. Sitting Bull had 3,000 warriors. Custer had 300. Captain Ransom shook his head. Mind you, Custer would have been killed sooner or later. He was vain and hard on his men. I'm surprised he wasn't accidentally shot in the back on the way into battle, as often happens with his type. I was with him in the Washita when he charged a village and then couldn't get himself out. Luck and bluff saved the day, but luck runs out eventually. He almost certainly brought this one on himself. And the Sioux hated him, wanted to kill him. But it's going to be a bloody war now. This whole country's red hot now. Well, Cope said, we're going to search for fossil bones in the Judith Badlands. Ransom stared at him in astonishment. I wouldn't, he said. There's trouble in the Judith River Basin? Not specifically, no, sir. Not that we know of. Well, then? Sir, most all the Indian tribes are on the warpath. Sitting Bull has 3,000 warriors somewhere in the south. Nobody knows where for sure, but we figure they'll head for asylum in Canada before winter, and that means they'll pass through the Judith Basin. That's fine, Cope said. We'll be safe for a few weeks during summer, for the reasons you just said. Sitting Bull isn't there. Sir, Ransom said, the Judith River is the shared hunting grounds of the Sioux and the Crow. Now, the Crow are usually peaceable, but these days they'll kill you as soon as look at you, because they can blame your deaths on the Sioux. That's not likely, Cope said. We're going. I have no orders to prevent you from going, Ransom said. I'm sure nobody in Washington ever imagined that anyone would go. To go out there is suicide, sir. For myself, I wouldn't go out with less than 500 trained cavalry at my side. I appreciate your concern, Cope said. You have done your duty in informing me. But I left Philadelphia with the intention of going to the Judith, and I will not turn back within 100 miles of my destination. Now, can you recommend a guide? Certainly, sir, Ransom said. But over the next 24 hours, the guides mysteriously became unavailable, as did horses, the provisions, and everything else that Cope had expected to obtain at Fort Benton. Yet he was undaunted. He simply offered more money, and more on top of that, until supplies began to become available after all. It was here they had their first glimpse of the famous iron will of Professor Cope. Nothing stopped him. They demanded $180, an outrageous sum, for a broken-down wagon. He paid it. They wanted even more for his four-wheelers and his four saddle ponies, the meanest ponies that ever picketed together, in Sternberg's estimation. They would sell him no food except beans and rice and cheap Red Dog whiskey. He bought what he could. Altogether, Cope spent $900 for his motley outfit, but he never complained. He kept his gaze fixed on his destination, the fossils of the Judith Basin. Finally, on July 6th, Ransom called him into the army stockade. It was the scene of bustling activity and preparation. Ransom told Cope that he had just received orders from the Department of War in Washington that no civilians were permitted to enter the disputed Indian lands in the Montana, Wyoming, or Dakota territories. I'm sorry to put a stop to your plans, sir, Ransom said politely, setting the telegram aside. You must do your duty, of course, Cope said, equally politely. Cope rejoined his group. They had already heard the news. I guess we have to go back, Sternberg said. Not yet, Cope said cheerfully. You know, I like Fort Benton. I think we should stay here a few days more. You like Fort Benton? Yes. It's pleasant and agreeable, and full of preparations. and Cope smiled. On July 8th, the Fort Benton cavalry set off to fight the Sioux, the column riding out while the band played The Girl I Left Behind Me. Later that day, a quite different group quietly slipped out. They were, wrote Johnson, a particularly motley crew. At the head of the column rode Edward Drinker Cope, United States paleontologist and millionaire. On his left rode Charlie Sternberg, occasionally bending to massage his stiff leg. On Cope's right rode Little Wind, their Shoshone scout and guide. Little Wind was proud in his bearing, and he had assured Cope that he knew the Judith River area like the face of his own father. Behind these three came J.C. Isaac, who kept a sharp eye on Little Wind. With him were the students, Leander Davis, Harold Chapman, George Morton, and Johnson. Bringing up the rear was the wagon pulled by its four stubborn horses, and driven by the teamster and cook, Sergeant Russell T. Hill. He was a fat, weathered man whose girth had persuaded Cope that he could cook. Teamster Hill was distinguished not only by his size and proficiency at swearing, so common among his trade, but also by his nicknames, which seemed to be endless. He was called Cookie, Chippy, Squinty, and Stinky. Hill was a man of few words, and those were most often repeated again and again. So, for example, when the students would ask him why he was called Cookie or Stinky or another of his names, he would invariably reply, "I reckon you'll see soon enough." And when confronted with an obstacle, however minor, Hill would always say, "Can't be done, can't be done." Finally, tethered to the wagon was Bessie, the mule that carried all Johnson's photographic supplies. Bessie was Johnson's responsibility, and he grew to hate her as the expedition went on. An hour after they started, they had left Fort Benton behind, and they were alone on the empty vastness of the Great Plains. Part 2. The Lost World. Night on the Plains. The first night they camped in a place called Claggett on the banks of the Judith River. There was a trading post here, surrounded by a stockade, but it had been recently abandoned. Hill cooked his first dinner, which they found heavy but otherwise acceptable. Hill used buffalo chips for fuel, thus explaining two of his nicknames, Chippy and Stinky. After dinner, Hill hung their food in a tree. "What are you doing that for?" Johnson asked. "That's to keep the food away from marauding grizzlies," Hill said. "Now go get ready to sleep." Hill himself stamped the ground with his boots before laying out his bedding. "What are you doing that for?" Johnson asked. "That's to stop up the snake holes," Hill said, "so the rattlers don't climb under the blankets with you at night."
"You're jobbing me," Johnson said.
"I ain't," Hill warned. "You ask anyone. Gets cold at night, and they like the warm, so they crawl right in with you, coil up against your groin."
Johnson went to Sternberg, who was also laying out his bedding.
"Aren't you going to stamp the ground?"
"No," Sternberg said. "This spot isn't lumpy. Looks real comfortable."
"What about rattlesnakes crawling into the blankets?"
"That hardly ever happens," Sternberg said.
"It hardly ever happens?"
Johnson's voice rose in alarm.
"I wouldn't worry over it," Sternberg said. "In the morning, just wake up slow and see if you got any visitors. Snakes just run away come morning."
Johnson shuddered. They had seen no sign of human life all day long, but Isaac was convinced they were at risk from Indians.
"With Mr. Indian," he grumbled, "the time you feel safest is the time you aren't."
Isaac insisted they post guards throughout the night. The others grudgingly went along. Isaac himself would take the last watch before dawn. This was Johnson's first night out under the great domed sky of the prairie, and sleep was impossible. The very thought of a rattlesnake or a grizzly bear would have prevented any sleep. But there were too many other sounds besides. The whisper of the wind in the grass, the hooting of owls in the darkness, the distant howls of coyotes. He stared up at the thousands of stars in the cloudless sky and listened. He was awake for each changing of the guard and saw Isaac take over from Sternberg at 4 o'clock in the morning. But eventually fatigue overcame him, and he was soundly asleep when a series of explosions jolted him awake. Isaac was shouting, "Halt! Halt, I say, halt!" as he fired his revolver. They all jumped up. Isaac pointed east across the prairie. "There's something out there. Can you see it? There's something out there." They looked and saw nothing. "I tell you, there's a man. A lone man." "Where?" "There. Out there." They stared at the distant horizon of the plains and saw nothing at all. Cookie unleashed a stream of epithets. "He's Injun shy and he's crazy too. He's gonna see a red man behind every bush long as we're out here. We won't get a lick of sleep." Cope quietly said that he would take over the watch and sent the others back to bed. It would be many weeks before they realized that Isaac had been right. If Stinky's food and Isaac's guarding left something to be desired, so did Little Wind's scouting. The Shoshone Brave got them lost for much of the following day. 2 hours after they set out, they came across fresh horse manure on the plains.
"Indians!"
Isaac gasped. Hill snorted in disgust. "Know what that is?" he said. "That's manure from our horses, that's what it is."
"That's impossible."
"You think so? See the wagon tracks over there?" He pointed to faint tracks where the prairie grass had been pressed down. "You want to bet I put the wheels of this wagon in those tracks and they line up exactly? We're lost, I tell you." Cope rode alongside Little Wind.
"Are we lost?"
"No," Little Wind said. "Well, what do you expect him to say?" Hill grumbled. "You ever heard an Indian admit he was lost?"
"I've never heard of an Indian being lost," Sternberg said.
"Well, we got one here, purchased at great expense," Hill said. "You mark my words, he's never been in this part of the country before, no matter what he says. And he's lost, no matter what he says."
For Johnson, the conversation filled him with strange dread. All day they had been riding under the great bowl of the sky, across uniformly flat country, a great vista without landmarks except for the occasional isolated tree or line of cottonwoods that marked a creek. It was truly a sea of grass, and like the sea, it was trackless and vast. He began to understand why everyone in the West talked so familiarly of certain landmarks. Pompey's Pillar, Twin Peaks, Yellow Cliffs. These few recognizable features were islands in the wide ocean of the prairie, and knowledge of their locations was essential for survival. Johnson rode alongside Toad.
"Can we really be lost?"
Toad shook his head.
"Indians are born here. They can read the land in ways we can't begin to imagine. We're not lost."
"Well, we're going south," Hill grumbled, staring at the sun. "Why are we going south when every man here knows that the Judith lands are east? Can someone tell me that?"
The next 2 hours were tense, until finally they came upon an old wagon track running east. Little Wind pointed.
"This road for wagons to Judith lands."
"That's what the problem was," Toad said.
"He's not used to traveling with a wagon, and he had to find the track for our wagon to use."
"The problem," Hill said, "is that he doesn't know the country."
"He knows this country," Sternberg said. "This is the Indian hunting lands we're in now."
They rode on in sober silence. Incidents on the Plains. In the middle of the still, hot afternoon, Johnson was riding alongside Cope, talking quite peaceably to him, when his hat suddenly flew away in the air, although there was no wind.
A moment later, they heard the snapping report of a long rifle, then another, and another. Someone was shooting at them.
Down! Cope shouted. Down!
They dismounted and ducked for cover, crawling beneath the wagon. In the distance, they could see a brown swirling dust cloud.
Oh, God,
Isaac whispered.
Indians.
The distant cloud grew in size, resolving into many silhouetted horsemen. More bullets whizzed through the air. The fabric of the wagon ripped. Bullets spanged off pots and pans. Bessie brayed in alarm.
We're done for,
Morton moaned.
Any minute now we'll hear those arrows whistling,
Isaac said.
And then, when they get closer, out come the tomahawks.
Shut up,
Cope said. He had never taken his eyes off the cloud.
They're not Indians.
Damn, if you're not a bigger fool than I thought you were. Who else had be- Isaac fell silent. The cloud was now close enough that they could resolve the riders into individual figures. Blue-coated figures.
Might still be red men, Isaac said, wearing Custer's jackets. For a surprise attack.
Not much surprise if they are. Little Wind squinted at the horizon. Not Indians, he pronounced finally. Saddle ponies.
Damn, Cookie shouted. The army. My boys in blue.
He leapt up shouting, waving his hands. A fusillade of lead sent him diving back beneath the wagon. The army horsemen rode around the wagon, whooping Indian style, firing their pistols into the air. Finally they stopped, and a young captain pulled up, his horse snorting. He aimed his revolver at the figures huddled beneath the wagon.
Out, you slime! Out! By God, I've a mind to finish you right here, every last man of you!
Cope emerged, purple with fury. His fists were clenched at his sides.
I demand to know the meaning of this outrage. You'll know it in hell, you blackguard,
the army captain said, and he shot twice at Cope, but his rearing horse threw off his aim.
Wait, Captain, one of the soldiers said.
By now Cope's party had all crawled from beneath the wagon and stood lined up along the wheels.
They don't look like gunrunners. Damn me if they're not, the captain said.
They could see now that he was drunk. His words were slurred. His body rocked precariously in the saddle.
Nobody but gunrunners would be out in this territory now. Supplying Mr. Indian with arms, when just last week 600 of our own dear lads have fallen to the savages. It's slime like you make it.
Cope drew himself up.
This is a scientific expedition,
he said.
Undertaken with the full knowledge and authorization of Captain Ransom at Fort Benton.
Balls, said the captain, and discharged his gun into the air for punctuation.
I am Professor Cope of Philadelphia, and I am a United States paleontologist and— Kiss my calico-covered arse, the captain said.
Cope lost his temper and leapt forward, and Sternberg and Isaac hurried to intervene.
Now, Professor, control yourself, Professor,
Sternberg yelled, as Cope struggled, shouting,
I want him! I want him!
In the ensuing confusion, the army captain fired three more times and wheeled on his horse.
Light 'em up, boys! Light 'em up!
But, Captain,
I said light 'em up!
More gunshots.
And I mean light 'em up!
There were still more gunshots. And Toad fell, shrieking,
I am hit! I am hit!
They rushed to help him. Blood poured freely from his hand. One of the soldiers rode up with a torch. The dry canvas of the wagon burst into flames. They turned to put out the fire, which roared fiercely. The cavalry wheeled around them, the captain shouting,
Teach him a lesson, boys! Teach him in hell!
And then, still firing, they turned and rode off. Cope's journal laconically notes, Have experienced first open hostilities today at the hands of U.S. cavalry. Fire put out with minimal damage, although we are without protective covering for wagon and two of our tents are burned. One horse shot dead. One student received flesh wound in hand. No serious injuries, thank God.
That night, it rained. Torrential, cracking thunderstorms continued all the next day and all that night. Cold and shivering, they huddled beneath the wagon, trying to sleep with the intermittent glaring flash of lightning showing them each other's haggard faces. The next day it rained again, and the trail was turned to mud, bogging down the wagons. They made only 2 miles of painful, soggy progress. But in the late afternoon, the sun burst through the clouds and the air became warmer. They felt better, especially when, climbing to the top of a gentle rise, they saw one of the great sights of the West. A herd of buffalo, stretching as far as the eye could see, dark shaggy shapes clumping on the yellow-green grass of the plains. The animals seemed peaceful, except for occasional snorting and bellowing. Cope estimated there were 2 million buffalo in the herd, perhaps more. "You are lucky to see it," he said. "In another year or two, herds like these will be only a memory." Isaac was nervous. "Where there are buffalo, there are Indians," he said, and he insisted they camp that night on high ground. Johnson was fascinated by the indifference of the animals to the arrival of men. Even when Sternberg went out and shot an antelope for dinner, the herd hardly responded. But Johnson later remembered that Cookie had said to Cope, "Shall I unhitch the wagon tonight?" And Cope looked at the sky and said thoughtfully, "Better not tonight." Meanwhile, the antelope was butchered and the flesh was found to be crawling with maggoty parasites. Cookie announced he had eaten worse, but they decided on a meal of biscuits and beans instead. Johnson recorded that, "I am already thoroughly sick of beans, with 6 more weeks of them still before me." But it was not all bad. They ate, sitting on a rocky outcrop beside the camp, and watched the buffalo tinge with red as the sun set behind them. And then, in the light of the moon, the shaggy shapes and the occasional distant snorting of the creatures made a vision of great majesty stretching away peacefully before us. Such were my thoughts as I turned in for a much-needed sleep. Lightning cracked the sky at midnight, and the rain began again. Grumbling and swearing, the students dragged their sleeping outfits under the wagon. Almost immediately, the rain stopped. They rolled on the hard ground, trying to get back to sleep. "Hell," Morton said, sniffing. "What is that smell?" "You're lying in horse shit," Toad said. "Oh, God, it's true." They were laughing at Morton's predicament, with the steady rumble of thunder still in their ears. Then suddenly Cope ran around the wagon, rudely kicking them. "Up, up! Are you mad? Get up!" Johnson glanced up and saw Sternberg and Isaac hastily loading the camp equipment, flinging it into the wagon. The wagon began to move over their heads as they scrambled out beneath. Cookie and Little Wind were shouting to each other. Johnson ran to Cope. His hair was matted down by the rain. His eyes were wild. Overhead, the moon raced among storm clouds. "What is it?" Johnson shouted over the rumbling thunder. "Why are we moving?" Cope shoved him roughly away. "The lee of the rocks! Get in the lee of the rocks!" Isaac had already gotten the wagon near the rocky outcrop, and Cookie was struggling with the horses, which snorted and reared, agitated. The students stared at each other, not understanding. And then Johnson realized the rumble they were hearing was not thunder. It was the buffalo. Terrorized by the lightning, the buffalo stampeded past the men in a wet, dense river of flesh that flowed around the rocks on both sides. They were all spattered by copious quantities of mud. For Johnson, it was a peculiar sensation, in that the mud covered our clothing, our hair, our faces, and we grew heavier as we became transformed into mud men, until finally we were all bowed over by the immense weight of it. They eventually could see nothing, and could only listen to the thundering hooves, the snorting and grunting, as the dark shapes hurtled past them ceaselessly. It seemed as if it went on forever. In fact, the herd had stampeded past them, without interruption, for 2 hours. Johnson awoke, his body stiff and aching. He was unable to open his eyes. He touched his face, felt the hard caked mud, and peeled it away. I was greeted by a sight of utter desolation, he later recalled, as if a hurricane or a whirlwind had struck us. There was only choppy mud as far as the eye could see, and our pitiful human party picking their way through it. Whatever of our camp outfit had been protected by the rocks was safe. Everything else was gone. 2 tents trampled into the mud so deeply we could not locate them in the morning. Heavy pots and cook pans dented and twisted by the passage of thousands of hooves. Tattered fragments of a yellow shirt. A carbine shattered and bent. They were greatly discouraged, particularly George Morton, who seemed to be in profound shock. Cookie argued to turn back, but as usual Cope was indomitable. I am not here to excavate trifling possessions from mud, he said. I am here to excavate prehistoric bones. Yes, Cookie said, if you ever get there. We will. He ordered them to break camp and pull out. Little Wind was particularly grim. He said something to Cope, and then galloped off to the north. Where's he going? George Morton asked in alarm. He doesn't believe the buffalo stampeded because of lightning, Cope said. He says they don't do that. I've known him to do it, Isaac said, in Wyoming. Stupid and unpredictable buffalo are. But what else could it be? Morton said, still alarmed. What does he think? He thinks he heard gunshots just before the stampede began. He is going to look. He's going to contact his fellow red men, Isaac muttered, and tell them where to find some nice white scalps. I think it's all ridiculous, Morton said petulantly. I think we should give it up and stop these wild chases. The shock of the stampede must have unnerved him, Johnson thought. He watched Morton poke through the mud, looking for his sketch pad. Little Wind was gone an hour, and he came back riding hard. One camp, he said, pointing north. 2 men, 2 or 3 ponies, 1 fire, 1 tent, 1 rifle shells. He opened his hand, and a cascade of copper jackets tumbled down in the sunlight. Well, I'll be, Sternberg said. It's Marsh's men, Cope said grimly. Did you see them? Morton asked. Little Wind shook his head. Left 1 hour. Which way did they go? Little Wind pointed east. The same direction they were going. Then we'll come across them again, Cope said. He clenched his fists. I'd enjoy that. Badlands. The Judith River, a tributary of the Missouri, flowed from the Little Belt Mountains and connected with large creeks in a confusing meander of waterways. There's damn good trout in those waters, said Cookie. Not that I expect we will be fishing. The Judith River Basin itself consisted of badlands, rocky outcrops that formed, for the eye, into mysterious shapes, demons and dragons. A place of gargoyles, said Toad. Toad's arm was now swollen and red. He complained of pain. Sternberg said privately he thought Toad would have to be sent back to Fort Benton, where the army surgeon could amputate his arm with the benefit of whiskey and a bone saw. But nobody mentioned it to Toad. The scale of the rock formations in the Judith Badlands was enormous. Great cliffs. Cope called them exposures, reaching hundreds of feet into the air, in places towering more than 1,000 feet above them. With pastel bands of pink and black rock, the land had a stark and desolate beauty. But it was a harsh land. There was little water nearby, and it was mostly brackish, alkaline, poisonous. Hard to believe this was a great inland lake, surrounded by swamps, Cope said, staring at the soft, sculpted rock. Cope always seemed to see more than the others did. Cope, and also Sternberg,
The tough fossil hunter had the practiced eye of a plains explorer. He always seemed to know where to find game and water. "We'll have water enough here," he predicted. "It won't be the water that troubles us. It'll be the dust." There was indeed an alkaline bite in the air, but the others did not mind it so much. Their immediate problem was to find a campsite near a suitable place for excavation, and this was no mean task. Moving the wagons over the terrain, there were no wagon trails here, was difficult and sometimes dangerous work. They were also nervous about Indians, because they saw plenty of signs around them. Pony tracks, abandoned cook fires, the occasional antelope carcass. Some of the cook fires looked recent, but Sternberg professed complete indifference. Even the Sioux weren't crazy enough to stay in the Badlands for long. "Only a crazy white man would spend all summer here," he laughed. "And only a crazy rich white man would spend his vacation here." He slapped Johnson on the back. For 2 days they pushed the wagons up hills and braced them down hills, until finally Cope announced that they were in a suitable bone region, and they could make camp at the next good site they found. Sternberg suggested the top of the nearby rise, and they pushed the wagons up a final time, coughing in the dust of the wheels. Toad, unable to help because of his swollen arm, said, "Do you smell fire?" But no one did. As they came to the top of the rise, they had a view over the plains and a meandering stream, with cottonwoods growing alongside it. And stretching as far as they could see were white teepees, each with a thin column of smoke issuing from them. "My God," Sternberg said. He quickly estimated the number.
"What do you make it?"
Isaac said.
"I make it more than 1,000 teepees."
"My God," Sternberg said again.
"I am persuaded," said Isaac, "that we are dead men."
"I reckon," said Cookie Hill. He spat on the ground. Sternberg didn't think so. The question was what tribe of Indians they were. If they were Sioux, then Isaac was right. They were as good as dead. But the Sioux were supposed to be still farther south.
"Who cares where they're supposed to be?" Cookie said. "They're here, and so were we. It's that little weasel. He led us here."
"That's enough. Let's go about our business," Cope said. "Make our camp and act naturally."
"After you, Professor," Cookie said.
It was difficult to act naturally with 1,000 teepees spread on the plains below, and the associated horses, fires, people. They had, of course, already been spotted. Some of the Indians were pointing and gesturing. By the time they had unloaded the cook wagon and started the fire for the night, a group of mounted horsemen splashed across the stream and rode up toward their camp.
"Here they come, boys," Cookie muttered.
Johnson counted 12 riders. His heart pounded as he heard their horses approach. They were superb horsemen, riding fast and easily, trailing a cloud of dust. They whooped and shouted savagely as they came closer.
"These were my first Indians," he later remembered, "and I was consumed in equal parts with curiosity and terror. I confess that to see the swirling dust cloud and hear their savage shrieks increased the latter, and for the 1,000th time on this journey I regretted the rashness of my wager."
The Indians were now close and rode in circles around the wagon, whooping enthusiastically. They knew the white men were frightened and enjoyed it. Finally they drew up, and their leader repeated several times,
"Hoa, hoa."
He said it in a grunting sort of way. Johnson whispered to Sternberg.
"What did he say?"
"He said how."
"What does that mean?"
"It means, I agree. Everything is fine. I feel friendly."
Johnson could now see the Indians clearly. Like many other first-time observers of Plains Indians, he was astonished at how handsome they were. Tall and muscularly endowed, their faces possessing pleasing regular features, their bearing naturally dignified and proud, their persons and buckskin garments surprisingly clean. The Indians were not smiling, but they seemed friendly enough. They all said "Hawa" in turn and looked around at the camp. There was an awkward silence. Isaac, who knew some Indian language, ventured a few words of greeting. Instantly their faces darkened. They wheeled on their horses and rode away, disappearing in an alkaline dust cloud. Sternberg said, "You goddamn fool, what did you say?"
"I said I bid you welcome and wish you success and happiness in the journey of your life."
"What did you say it in?"
"Mandan?"
"You goddamn fool."
"Mandan, Sioux talk.
Those are crows." Even Johnson had been long enough in the plains to know of the traditional enmity between the Sioux and the Crow tribes. The hatred between them was deep and implacable, especially since in recent years the Crows had allied themselves with the white soldiers in the fight against the Sioux.
"Well, Mandan's all I know," Isaac protested.
"So I said it."
"You goddamn fool,"
Sternberg repeated. "If we didn't before, now we have a problem."
"I thought crows never killed white people,"
Morton said, licking his lips. "That's what the crows say," Sternberg said, "but they tend to exaggerate. Oh yes, lads, we have a problem." "Well, we'll go down there and straighten it out," Cope said, in his usual forthright manner. "After our last supper?" Cookie said. "No," Cope said. "Now."
The Indian Village. Aboriginal peoples had hunted on the western plains of America for more than 10,000 years. They had seen the glaciers recede and the land become warm. They had witnessed, and perhaps accelerated, the disappearance of the great mastodons, the hippo, and the feared saber-toothed tiger. They had hunted when the land was heavily forested, and they hunted now that it was a sea of grass. Through all the thousands of years, through all the changes of game and climate, Indians had continued to live as nomadic hunters on the vast spaces of the land. The Plains Indians of the 19th century were colorful, dramatic, mystical, warlike people. They captured the imagination of all who saw them, and in many ways they stood, in the popular mind, for all American Indians. The antiquity of their rituals, the intricate organization of their way of life, was much admired by liberal thinkers. But the truth was that the Plains Indian society that Westerners saw was hardly older than the white American nation that now threatened its existence. The Plains Indians were a nomadic hunting society organized around the horse, as were the Mongols of Asia. Yet there had been no horses in America until the Spaniards introduced them 300 years earlier, changing Plains Indian society beyond recognition. And even the traditional tribal structures and tribal rivalries were less ancient than often imagined. Most authorities believed the Crow Indians were once part of the Sioux Nation, living in what is now Iowa. They had migrated west toward Montana, evolved a separate identity, and become the implacable antagonists of their former kin. As one expert wrote, "The Sioux and the Crow are virtually the same in dress, manner, habits, language, customs, values, bearing. This similarity might be thought to form the basis of friendship, yet it only heightens their antagonism." It was these Crow Indians that they now rode down to visit. First impressions of an Indian village were often contradictory. Henry Morton Stanley, the Welsh explorer and journalist who in 1871 famously found Dr. David Livingstone in Africa, entered Black Kettle's village with Custer and found it filthy. So foul, indeed, as to defy description. Robes on the teepee floors were crawling with vermin. Excremental odors assailed him. Other first-time observers were unnerved to see Indians roasting a dog over a fire or chewing bloody buffalo steaks. But Johnson's first impressions, riding that evening into the Crow village, seem more revealing about him than about the Crow.
Anyone who imagines, he wrote, that the nomadic Indian lives a free-spirited and open life will receive a rude shock on visiting his place of habitation. The Plains Indian village is like the life of the warrior, regimented in the extreme. Teepees are regularly designed of elk hide, regularly set out, and regularly arranged according to fixed rules. There are rules for placement of the backrests inside the teepees, and rugs, and rawhide containers. There are rules for the designs that decorate the robes and clothes and teepees. Rules for the making of fires and the manners of cooking. Rules for the behavior of the Indian at every moment and at all times in his life. Rules for war and rules for peace. And rules for hunting and rules for behavior before hunting. And all these rules are followed with a rigid fixity and a serious determination which forcibly reminds the observer that one is among a warrior race. They tethered their horses at the edge of the village and walked in slowly. Curious stares greeted them from every side. Laughing children fell silent, paused to watch the strangers pass. Odors of cooking venison and the peculiar pungency of drying hides assaulted their nostrils. At length, a young brave came up and made some elaborate movements with his hands.
"What's he doing?" whispered Johnson.
"Sign language," Toad said, cradling his swollen arm with the other.
"You understand it?"
"No," Toad said. But Little Wind did, and he spoke to the brave in the Crow language. The Indian led them deeper into the village, to a large teepee where five older warriors sat around a fire in a semicircle.
"The chiefs," Toad whispered.
At a gesture from one, the white men all sat in a semicircle facing them. "Then began," wrote Johnson, "the most protracted negotiations I ever experienced in my life. The Indians love to talk and are in no rush. Their curiosity, the formal elaborateness of ceremonial speech, and the lack of urgency with regard to time peculiar to them, all conspired to a meeting of acquaintance that clearly would take all night. Everything was discussed. Who we were, including our names and the meaning of our names. Where we had come from, the cities, the meanings of the names of cities, what routes we had taken, how we had chosen the route, and what experiences we had had on our journey. Why we were here, the reason for our interest in the bones, and how we planned to excavate them, and what we planned to do with them, what we were wearing as clothing, and why, the meaning of rings and trinkets and belt buckles, and so on ad infinitum et ad nauseam." If the powwow seemed interminable, it must have in part been because of the tension the whites felt. Sternberg noted that they didn't care overly for our answers. It soon emerged that they knew about Cope, had been told that he was unfriendly to Indians, and had killed his own father. The Crow had been advised to kill him in turn. Cope was furious, but kept his temper. Smiling pleasantly, he said to the others, "Do you see the villainy? The black scoundrel's techniques finally exposed to all eyes? Do I harass Marsh? Do I attempt at every juncture to impede his progress? Am I jealous of him? I ask you. I ask you." The chiefs could tell that Cope was upset, and Little Wind hastened to assure them of an error. The Indians insisted there was no error. Cope had been described well and true. "Who has said these things about him?" Little Wind asked. "Red Cloud Agency." "Red Cloud Agency is a Sioux agency." "This is so." "The Sioux are your enemy." "This is so." "How can you believe the words of an enemy?" The discussion dragged on, hour after hour. At length, to control his temper or perhaps his nerves, Cope began to sketch. He drew the chief, and the likeness aroused great interest. The chief wanted the sketch, and Cope gave it to him. The chief wanted Cope's pen. Cope refused.
Professor, Sternberg said. I think you'd better give him your pen.
I will do nothing of the sort.
Professor. Very well.
Cope handed over the pen. Shortly before dawn, the discussion turned from Cope to Toad. Some kind of new chief was called for. A very pale, very thin man with a wild look in his eyes. His name was White Deer. White Deer looked at Toad and muttered something and left. The Indians then announced they wanted Toad to remain in the camp and for the others to leave. Cope refused.
It's all right, Toad said. I will serve as a kind of hostage.
They may kill you.
But if they kill me, Toad pointed out, they'll almost certainly kill all of you soon after.
In the end, Toad remained, and the others left. From their camp, they looked down on the Indian encampment as dawn broke. The braves had begun whooping and riding in circles. A large fire was being built.
Poor Toad, Isaac said. They'll torture him for sure.
Cope watched through his glass, but the smoke obscured everything. Now a chanting began. It kept up until 9 in the morning, when it abruptly stopped. A party of braves rode up to the camp, bringing Toad with them on a spare horse. They came upon Cope washing his false teeth in a tin bowl. The Indians were entranced, and before Toad dismounted, insisted that Cope pop his lifelike teeth in and then take them out again. Cope did this several times, contrasting a dazzling smile with a gaping toothless hole, and the Indians departed, much entertained. Dazed, Toad watched them go.
That one chief, White Deer, did magic on my hand, he said, to cure it.
Did it hurt?
No. They just waved feathers over it and chanted. But I had to eat some awful stuff.
What stuff?
I don't know, but it was awful. I'm very tired now.
He curled up beneath the wagon and slept for the next 12 hours. Toad's arm was improved the following morning. In 3 days, he was cured. Each morning, the Indians would ride up to see Cope, and they would watch Funny Tooth wash his teeth. The Indians would often hang around the camp, but they never took anything, and they were very interested in what the whites were doing, finding bones.
Bone Country.
With these preliminary problems resolved, Cope was impatient to begin the work. The students found him standing in the dawn chill, glancing up at the cliffs near the camp, which were being struck with light for the first time that day. Abruptly, he leapt up and said, "Come along, come along. Quickly now. This is the best time to look."
"Look for what?"
the students asked, surprised. "You'll know soon enough." He led them to the cliff face exposure nearest the camp and pointed.
"See anything?"
They looked. They saw bare, eroded rock, predominantly gray in color, with pink and dark gray striations highlighted in the weak morning sunlight. That was all they saw.
"No bones?" Cope asked.
Encouraged by this hint, they looked hard, squinting in the light. Toad pointed.
"How about up there?"
Cope shook his head. "Just embedded boulders." Morton pointed.
"Near the rise there?"
Cope shook his head. "Too high. Don't look up there." Johnson tried his luck.
"Over there?"
Cope smiled.
"Dead sagebrush. Well, it seems you can see everything but the bones. Now, look in the middle of the cliff. For a cliff this high will have its Cretaceous zone near the middle. A lower cliff, it might be nearer the top. But this one, it will be in the middle. Just below that pink striation band there. Now run your eye along the band until you see a kind of roughness. See there? That oval patch there?
Those are bones."
They looked, and then they saw. The bones caught the sunlight ever so differently from the rock, rounded edges more muted than jagged stone, their color a shade different. Once pointed out, it became easy. They saw another patch there, and more there, and there again, and still more. "We realized," wrote Johnson, "that the entire cliff face was fairly stuffed to bursting with bones, which previously were invisible to us, yet now were as plain as the nose on your face. But as Professor Cope says, we had to learn to recognize the nose on your face, too. He likes to say, nothing is obvious." They were discovering dinosaurs. In 1876, scientific acceptance of dinosaurs was still fairly recent. At the turn of the century, men did not suspect the existence of these great reptiles at all, although the evidence was there to see. Back in July 1806, William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition explored the south bank of the Yellowstone River in what would later become Montana Territory and found a fossil cemented within the face of the rock. He described it as a bone 3 inches in circumference and 3 feet in length and considered it the rib of a fish, although it was probably a dinosaur bone. More dinosaur bones were found in Connecticut in 1818. They were believed to be the remains of human beings. Dinosaur footprints, discovered in the same region, were described as the tracks of Noah's raven. The true meaning of these fossils was first recognized in England. In 1824, an eccentric English clergyman named Buckland described the Megalosaurus, or great fossil lizard of Stonesfield. Buckland imagined the fossil creature to be more than 40 feet long, and with a bulk equal to that of an elephant 7 feet high. But this remarkable lizard was considered an isolated specimen. The following year, Gideon Mantell, an English physician, described Iguanodon, a newly discovered fossil reptile. Mantell's description was based largely on some teeth found in an English quarry. Originally, the teeth were sent to Baron Cuvier, the greatest anatomist of his day. He pronounced them the incisors of a rhinoceros. Dissatisfied, Mantell remained convinced that I had discovered the teeth of an unknown herbivorous reptile, and eventually demonstrated that the teeth most resembled those of an iguana, an American lizard. Baron Cuvier admitted his error, and wondered, "Do we not have here a new animal, an herbivorous reptile of another time?" Other fossil reptiles were unearthed in rapid succession. Hylaeosaurus in 1832, Macrodontophion in 1834, Thecodontosaurus and Paleosaurus in 1836, Plateosaurus in 1837. With each new discovery came the growing suspicion that the bones represented a whole group of reptiles that had since vanished from the earth. Finally, in 1841, another physician and anatomist, Richard Owen, proposed the entire group be called Dinosauria, or terrible lizards. The notion became so widely accepted that in 1854, full-size reconstructions of dinosaurs were built in the Crystal Palace in Sydenham and attained wide popularity with the public. Owen, knighted by Queen Victoria for his accomplishments, later became a bitter opponent of Darwin and the doctrine of evolution. By 1870, the focus on dinosaur hunting shifted from Europe to North America. It had been recognized since the 1850s that there were large numbers of fossils in the American West, but recovery of these giant bones was impractical until the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. The following year, Cope and Marsh began their furious competition to acquire fossils from this new region. They undertook their labors with all the ruthlessness of a Carnegie or a Rockefeller. In part, this aggressiveness, new to scientific endeavors, reflected the prevailing values of their age. And in part, it was a recognition of the fact that dinosaurs were no longer mysterious. Cope and Marsh knew exactly what they were about.
they were discovering the full range of a great order of vanished reptiles. They were making scientific history. And they knew that fame and honor would accrue to the man who discovered and described the largest number. The two men were consumed by the search. "Hunting for bones," wrote Johnson, "has a peculiar fascination, not unlike hunting for gold. One never knows what one will find, and the possibilities, the potential discoveries lying in wait, fuels the quest." And they did indeed make discoveries. While they dug the hillside, Cope was kept busy on the ground below, sketching, making notes, and classifying. He insisted that the students be meticulous in recording which bones were found in proximity to which others. Shovel and pickaxe were used to loosen the stone, but they gave way to the smaller tools, which appeared simple enough, hammer, chisel, pick, and brush. Despite the students' earnestness, there was first a great deal of technique to be learned. They had to learn to choose among the three weights of wide-head hammer, four widths of rock chisel, imported from Germany, explained Cope, for the quality of the cold steel, two sizes of steel points to pick at the stone, and a variety of stiff brushes for whisking away dirt and dust and gravel. "We've come too far not to do this the correct way," Cope said. "The fossils don't always give themselves up easily, too." One did not just bang a fossilized bone out of the rock, he explained to them. One studied the position of the fossil, tapped the stone with a chisel when necessary, hammered vigorously only rarely. To find the subtle demarcation between bone and stone, it was necessary to see color difference. "Sometimes it helps just to spit on it," Cope said. "The moisture heightens the contrast." "I'm going to die of thirst pretty quickly," muttered George Morton. "And don't just look at what you were doing," Cope instructed. "Listen, too. Listen to the sound of the chisel hitting the stone. The higher the note, the harder the stone." He also demonstrated the right position to extract the fossils, depending upon the slope of the rock. They worked on their bellies, on their knees, squatting, and sometimes while standing. When the rock face was especially sharp, they hammered in a spike and secured themselves with ropes. They were to understand how the angle of the sun revealed not just the face of the stone, but also its fissures and unexpected depths. Johnson found himself recalling how challenging it had been for him to learn to take photographs, extracting fossils from the grasp of stone without damaging them was far more difficult. Cope showed them how to position their tools next to the hand that would use those tools, and to work as efficiently as possible, for in a day each student would switch from hammer and chisel to pick to brush and back again, in all combinations hundreds of times. Left-handers kept their chisels to their right, brushes to their left. "The work is more tiring than you expect," he told them. And indeed it was. "My fingers hurt, my wrists hurt, my shoulders hurt, and also my knees and feet," said George Morton after the first few days. "Better you than me," Cookie said. As the bones came down to the camp, Cope laid them on a dark wool blanket for contrast, staring at them until he saw how they related to each other. In late July, he announced a new duck-billed Hadrosaurus. A week later, a flying reptile. And then in August, they found a Titanosaurus, and finally the teeth of a Champsosaurus. "We are finding wonderful dinosaurs," exulted Cope. "Wonderful, marvelous dinosaurs." The work was exhausting, backbreaking, sometimes dangerous. For one thing, the scale of the landscape was, as in the rest of the West, deceptive. What appeared to be a small cliff exposure turned out, on climbing, to be 500 or 600 feet high. Scrambling up these sheer crumbling faces, working halfway up the hill, maintaining balance on the incline, was fatiguing in the extreme. It was a strange world. Often, working on these huge rocky faces, they were so far apart they could hardly see each other.
But because the land was so quiet and the curving cliffs acted like giant funnels, they could hold clear conversations no louder than a whisper, even within the constant sound of the reverberating pings and soft